Thank you, Scott, Suzanne, and CEDA for organising this very interesting forum. It's looking increasingly clear that Australia has avoided the large falls in housing prices seen in some other countries over the past 2 years or so. This is a good thing because of the macroeconomic difficulties that have accompanied price falls in some countries. But looking forward, the risk is that we might move towards undesirably strong price growth in Australian housing prices. This raises a number of concerns. In this talk, I'm going to discuss some graphs which cover three topics: developments in the cost of housing in Australia, developments in the supply and demand for new housing, and the consequences and incidence of high housing prices. The full version of my remarks with my graphs will be on the bank's website. First, to developments in housing affordability. This graph shows a standard measure of affordability for home ownership, with higher values corresponding to better affordability. It shows there's been a significant improvement over the past year or so. But this next graph shows that the improvement is due more to movements in interest rates than in housing prices. Mortgage rates, the green line, are particularly low at present. But as the bank has noted on a number of occasions, it is not reasonable to expect that rates will stay at current low levels indefinitely. When they do rise to more normal levels, discussions on housing affordability will again focus more on the level of housing prices relative to incomes, the blue line in this graph. Over the past 5 years, housing prices have risen less rapidly than incomes. This was a positive development, which reduced the vulnerability of our economy going into the global financial crisis. Nevertheless, the ratio of Australian housing prices to incomes is still high, relative to earlier decades or compared with other countries. The long upward trend in the purchase price of housing has also affected renters. This graph shows some new data from the 2007-08 Survey of Income and Housing. The left panel shows that renters over the past decade have tended to pay a noticeably larger proportion of their incomes in rent than they did 25 years ago. And the right panel shows that housing stress remained quite high among renters in 2007-08. And my second topic concerns supply and demand factors, especially for new housing. In recent years, there's been much discussion of the extent of the supply shortage in the housing market, or the extent to which supply has fallen short of what is called underlying demand. In practice, underlying demand is typically calculated as the sum of four components, as shown on this slide. I'm going to focus on the first two. By far the largest is demand due to growth in the population. We've had strong population growth in recent years, coming from higher rates of both natural increase and immigration. This graph highlights the 2.1% population increase over the year to the March quarter. By itself, without any contribution from the other factors, this growth would imply demand for around 165,000 new dwellings a year, which is much more than we've been doing in recent years. This highlights the need to have a responsive supply side, something I'll return to. The second major component of underlying demand is from changes in average household size. Over many decades, average household size has fallen significantly. But the latest data from the most recent census year reveal an interesting fact shown in this graph. The ABS estimates imply that the long decline in average household size was interrupted between 2001 and 2006. Average household size is estimated to have risen slightly over this period, a marked change from earlier decades. Now, this may partly reflect demographic factors. However, it might also be a reflection of the significant rise in the cost of housing over recent decades. The effective or actual demand for housing, as opposed to the underlying demand, will partly depend on its price. Hence, the large undersupply of housing might not be as big as sometimes thought. But this is not necessarily something that should reassure us. It may be that the higher cost of housing, partly reflecting supply-side factors, has choked off some of the demand that might otherwise have existed. There's another interesting demand-side development in the data for average weekly hours worked by households. This graph shows a significant increase over several decades in the hours worked by households headed by 25 to 39-year-olds, the age when households tend to enter into home ownership. This is presumably related to the rise in housing prices, both as cause and effect. In particular, social trends such as the rise in female labour force participation have increased incomes, which will have contributed to stronger demand for housing. But to the extent that this has boosted the price of housing, it will also have contributed to some households needing to work longer hours. I'll now turn to the supply side. In an ideal world, supply would be quite responsive to changes in underlying demand, and only a limited increase in the overall price of housing would be required to bring on new supply, either from newly developed land on the fringes or conversion of land from lower to higher density use closer to city centres. However, there's a wide range of evidence that the supply side has not been all that responsive in recent years. Here I'm thinking about the problems that have been with us for some time, rather than the current shortage of financing for apartment building and land development, which will hopefully ease as conditions continue to normalise in financial markets. In particular, even if one discounts some of the reports from the housing and land development industries, it's clear that there have been problems in recent years in the zoning and development and building approvals processes. An extreme example was perhaps on the fringes of Sydney, where in the middle of this decade, proposed infrastructure contributions in some new developments would have come to as much as $100,000 per lot. Fortunately, there's been some progress in Sydney where these charges have fallen somewhat, although infrastructure charges have recently risen in some other capitals. One summary indicator of the land release and development process may be the cost of land for housing on our city fringes. The orange bars in this graph show the cost of lower-priced blocks of land in new developments, which appear fairly expensive in Sydney, Brisbane, and Perth. And the average price of all transacted lots, the blue bars, is significantly above those levels. Factors that boost the cost of new land on the fringe and reduce new supply must inevitably impact on the broader cost of housing in our cities. But zoning and development approvals issues are also very important closer to our city centres. Given that some increase in density is inevitable as the populations of our cities grow, this will put greater focus on the replacement of existing housing with higher density housing. Of course, this process is frequently unpopular with existing residents, so there are all sorts of difficult issues for state governments and local councils to deal with. Nevertheless, if housing affordability is a concern, it will be necessary to keep working to reduce impediments to the construction of new housing, both inside our cities and at the fringes. And good public transport will also be important, both for new developments on the fringe and to make it more feasible to commute into our major cities from nearby urban centres. My third point is a reminder on the consequences and incidence of higher housing prices. It's important to remember that housing is not just a dinner party conversation, but a consumption item. We all need to consume some level of housing services, either rented or purchased. So a higher level of housing prices and rents allows less spending over our lifetimes on other items. And there are some important generational and income distributional aspects to changes in housing prices and rents. This graph reminds us that lower income households are less likely to own housing, either their own home, the blue bars, or an investment property, the orange bars, than higher income ones. So when the price of housing rises, higher income households tend to benefit at the expense of lower income households. So, as I have noted before, as a nation, we are not really any richer when the price of housing rises, but the more vulnerable tend to get hurt. In conclusion, I think it's becoming well understood that supply-side factors, in addition to the well-known demand-side ones, have contributed to the relatively high level of housing prices in Australia. In addition, the social impacts of declining housing affordability are becoming well understood. Fortunately, there's been some progress on a number of fronts. Indicators of private home building have been picking up, and completions in the year ahead are likely to be well above recent low levels. An expansion in the supply of public and affordable housing is also occurring after a long decline in its share in the total dwelling stock. In addition, governments, both state and federal, are taking some steps that will help to free up the supply side. But there clearly is scope for further progress. Population growth and the demand for housing are strong. Further, as the recovery picks up steam, labour shortages in the building industry may again emerge. Looking ahead, we can be fairly confident that the housing market, like other markets, will clear. The task for public policies is to help ensure that this occurs with relatively higher construction volumes and lower growth in prices, rather than vice versa. Thank you.
Now, I've just got a couple of quick questions to kick proceedings off. And Tony, from what the remarks that you made, and the Reserve Bank has always put a lot of emphasis lately, or I should not say lately, for quite a while, particularly under the former governor, as to supply side policies towards housing. You made mention of that in your speech before. How far along are we in that process? As you said, we've started to see some action in Sydney in terms of bringing the actual construction cost down. You said, but other states, the infrastructure costs have started to rise, and you think we need to see more action on that front. How far along are we in that cycle? Like, what else needs to be done? Are there any sort of particular policy measures that the bank thinks should be put in place to essentially bring on that supply?
Good question, Scott. I should preface it by saying that we at the Reserve Bank are not experts at the in the supply process. But we've been looking at that land price series for a little while. What is essentially the cheapest block of land you could buy on the Sydney Fringe? And when we looked at it early last year, it was just under 200,000. It's a little bit further under 200,000. It's 185, 190,000, something like that. That seems too high. That there must be some problems in the supply process. I think, quite simply, state and local governments have to say, what can we do to get land prices on the fringe of our cities lower? Melbourne can do it for about 100,000. What is it that Sydney and New South Wales could be doing to reduce it? I think it's not going to be an easy process. There are some very difficult processes, very difficult questions. Julian Disney referred to some of the problems this morning, but we need to focus on it, and it's going to take a long time.
And Tony, as much as I think we'd all like you to give us some kind of insight as to what will be happening in the next two Reserve Bank meetings, I'm sure you won't. Well, how much emphasis, and this is a question you can bat away if you'd like, but in the policy decision meetings, you know, the first Tuesday of every month, how much emphasis going forward do you think will be placed on the stimulus? We've seen the Reserve Bank Governor make his comments yesterday. How much emphasis, how much weighting will the Central Bank Board be putting on the stimulus measures that we have in this economy right now?
I think it's probably better if we stick to stick to questions housing today, Scott. The stimulus is one of the stimulus package is one of the many things influencing the economy at the moment, and the bank will be looking at all of those factors. Mm.
Thanks, Shane Henderson from Boral. My question's for Tony Richards. I just wonder if the Reserve Bank is with the emergency level of policy stimulus that's been out there for a while. They're starting to get concerned about household leverage and perhaps a debt bubble emerging.
The developments in asset prices, developments in indebtedness are obviously some of the many, many factors we look at. But I think, as Rory has noted, 6 months ago, the concern was that we would see unhelpfully, 6 months, 9 months ago, the concern was that we'd see unhelpfully large declines in asset prices. Clearly, that threat has passed. I think we're in a situation where we would not want to see very strong growth in housing prices. That would be unhelpful from a social perspective in Australia. And a question, how indebtedness, clearly that's something we look at. The evidence of the past year, though, is that Australian households have, for the most part, not incurred levels of debt that they're unable to service. So I think over the past year we've seen that the economy is fairly flexible, fairly robust, and that we've been able to withstand the global financial crisis.
Steve Gatt from KPMG. The banks are not lending on any large-scale residential development at the moment. With the onset of Basel II requirements and the additional capital that banks are going to have to set aside, that's going to probably make their appetite for large-scale development even less. And on the accounting front, whilst the big property trusts who participate in property development have recapitalised recently to restore their balance sheets, chances are they're not really allocating a lot of that capital for property development. So, and that's also exacerbated by the fact that the accounting rules have changed a couple of years ago, where CEOs who invested in property development don't get to recognise any of the profit till the back end of the property development, and so why would you bother investing in that asset class? So all in all, that sends me a message that, you know, there's not going to be a lot of people investing in residential development activities, which is going to exacerbate the supply shortage that we have. Mm. A shortage of supply tend to me to head towards an increase in prices. What I'd like to understand is the Reserve Bank increase or forecast increase in interest rates to avoid the asset price bubble, or are there other factors that are driving the motivation of the Reserve Bank?
Just one comment, Stephen. The Australian population seems to have a fixation on property, and that was the nature of your question, was assuming that the Reserve Bank Board does too. The Board doesn't set interest rates for any particular sector of the economy. The Board will set interest rates based on the level of rates that are appropriate for the economy as a whole. You highlighted some of the regulatory and accounting rules that might be reducing the supply of funding to property development. But I think there's also just a degree of risk aversion out there. And I think at some point the banks say, oh, actually, we are happy to lend to property development after all. I don't know if it's 2 weeks away, 2 months away, or a lot longer than that. But at some point, I think one bank starts lending more for property and the others follow.